Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Good Areas Live. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. With me is my mate, Rob Barron. You can find him at Moso Judge on Twitter. And we are here to review an English victory for a change. That's going to be fun.
But yeah,
before we get into it, just like to remind everyone that all of our shows on the Good Areas Network, they are powered by our supporters on Patreon. You can become one of them by going to patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. That way you can enjoy ad-free content, you can talk to us exclusively, and you can even give us podcast recommendations. All right, Rob, explain the jacket. I'm loving it, and Merry Christmas.
I can hear you now. I'd imagine that was an amazing intro that you just gave me, but yeah.
No, I asked you a question. I said, Merry Christmas, and I want you to explain the jacket because it's really funky and I love it. Is it Cameroon?
It's Ghana. I do have a Cameroon jacket, but it's Ghana. But my wife won't let me wear it anywhere near the house, so I have to put this sort of stuff on when I talk to you, Behram. But yeah, they're in. It's AFCON time now, isn't it? Something I don't have any time to watch because there's cricket on 24 hours a day. But yeah, here we are. We're celebrating an England victory that we all knew was coming, and we kept telling you how good England were, and they finally fulfilled their potential. I don't know. Like, what did you think of it, Behram? It didn't look like a test that's going to go down as memorable for the neutral.
Well, when a test match ends in 2 days and in that sort of fashion, it's not particularly palatable. It's better than playing on roads, but I'll get to all of that stuff in a bit because this is basically what the show is going to be about. Lots of talk on the playing conditions and whatnot. There's a really fun comment over here by ATT Back, who says, is Barron also coming from a vacation from Noosa? I assume he is because he won a lot of quid before Christmas, so he must have celebrated merrily.
Well, I've certainly done the overeating bit of Christmas and repping Ghana, who aren't even in the AFCON, I don't think, this year. But I had an overly good Christmas, buying enough food for 12 people and then 3 people in my house.
Lovely.
And trucking our way through it. But that's what you do in this country because we're all daft, as the cricket team show on a regular basis.
I wonder if you will end up watching more of this AFCON or Jamie Carragher, because it's not a big trophy for him. I'm sorry, this is like the second time I'm throwing shade on Jamie Carragher on the show, but I think it's worth every minute. Look, first of all, congratulations to the English fans. Ultimately, a 4-wicket win within 2 days. The series was gone. It's 3-1, but at least England have finally managed to win a test match in Australia for the first time in 19 tests and for the first time since 2011. And I suppose my summary of this, I know we're going to get into the details, but my initial thought is that it had to be one of those chaotic test matches for England to scrape away with a victory. And you really do want a baseball, you know, when one of those deliveries has got your name written on it. I feel like that's a really good ploy in that sort of a situation.
Yeah, and Australia made huge mistakes for every bit of the test match. Their preparation was terrible. They're in the pub and like publicly, you know, Travis Head was leathered for a couple of days between test matches, which you can do when you're 3-0 up. You can't do when you're 2-0 down, which is what England did. But yeah, Australia elected to go to the pub, not all of them, but most of them did. And Travis Head clearly gets his pub hours in between games anyway. So, you know, who knows about that. But if you watch the first morning, Australia looked like a team that were bleary-eyed and had enjoyed Christmas Day rather than been hyper laser-focused on the 5-0. But what you don't do against England is create the chaos, because that's what England are good at. England are the best at that. And they've been trying to be chaos for several years. They wussed out of the chaos, which I panned them enough for in Test 2 and 3, when they elected to block when they had the best conditions. And this time, the best possible way to win that match against an undercooked and possibly slightly dozy Australia, who I kept saying aren't actually all that good, particularly the batting. The best way to beat them there is full baseball, smash, 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 chaos, chaos, chaos. And they got the absolute pitch where that tactic is totally correct, because it was lateral movement. You know, the ball's got your name on is what everybody says. And it did, right? Everybody was struggling. Nobody got 50 in a test match for the first time in 500 years or whatever it is. No one got 50. And 40 was like a mega achievement. It's like a double ton at Rawalpindi, isn't it? 400, like 40 seemed to be extremely difficult to get. And the guys that had success came out and smoked it. Yeah, there were silly shots. There's always going to be silly shots with England. And you know, we were all shouting at the screen when Brooke came in and played the ridiculous shot at 8-3 off his first ball. But it worked. And this was the test where I'm really, really pleased that I was screaming at them to do it in the third test. And don't go away and run away from your brand now and start wussing out and blocking. That was the test to hammer it, because if they'd have meekly come out and blocked, they'd have got rolled twice, and Australia probably would have done enough. We'll come on to why Australia didn't win this test in a minute, because they made some huge mistakes. But England did the right thing. They upped the volatility. When you're the second favourite or the outsider, you up the volatility, you do the mad stuff, and you hope that the cards fall for you, right? And they did for England in this test match. I think they got quite lucky with the decisions, whereas they've not been so lucky in previous tests. They got quite lucky with the decisions. Conditions, they didn't get lucky, because it was the same for both teams from what I saw.
Yeah.
And the bit of why they chased it, for me, was that they came out and smashed the hell out of the ball. Mm. And so the ball got slightly easier for batting towards the end of the chase, which was a short chase anyway, because England had smashed the hell out of it and started whacking it into those LED boundary boards that got it softer.
True.
Stark looked tired. He was spraying it a bit. He was bowling down the leg side. I mean, it was, as far as quality goes, and we said this before the series, this ain't going to be a test match of the ages where you've got two great teams going against each other. The quality was desperate in that test match.
I suppose...
It was really shit.
To echo Mashal's sentiment, he said that, you know, it was Tier 2 cricket, and had this test match been played between West Indies and Bangladesh, people would have calling for their removal, you know, from test status. And I do see, you know, some sense in there. Like, I understand why he would make that comment. But look, there was a lot of chaos. England needed that bit of chaos. It was a lottery pitch. I mean, as you mentioned, no single batter got to 50. A 40 was like a 150 on the surface. The scores in each innings were 152 all out, 132 all out. That was in the third, sorry. So 152 all out, followed by 110 all out. Australia with a 42 run lead. Then they're 132 all out. And then England managed to chase down 178 or whatever with four wickets in hand. And I mean, you've got to say that, you know, there is this sort of notion that people often associate baseball to only be successful on flat decks. Whereas I have always said, even when they play on rank turners, that baseball is a good ploy. It's just that they lack the skills. And it gets a wee bit easier for them on an extremely pace-friendly wicket as opposed to a rank turner when they up the volatility. You know, they give themselves an even chance to win that game, because when you go for every ball, when one of those balls is going to get you out anyway, you kind of, you know, take the attack straight back to the opposition. And Australia, as you said, were a bit knackered. They were a bit, you know, their bellies were full with ham and beer, I suppose, and champagne. So, yeah, the one thing that you really said that kind of intrigued me is something that Steve Smith also said. That Crockett, as I like to call them, right, 51-run partnership between Duckett and Crawley in that fourth innings. Finally, we got to see something from those two, because I have always felt that baseball's success hinges a lot on the success of the opening pair. Not individually, but as a pair itself. They did take the sting out of the new ball in the fourth innings, and that helped massively, right? It softened the seam. And Steve Smith said the same thing, that when the ball hit the LED boards, the seam got softened and it got a wee bit easier. But still, I mean, you know, England of old, which didn't baseball, would have completely kind of blown this apart. Like, they would have gotten all out for 110. Easy. I can see that.
Well, imagine McGrath and Warne on that pitch, right? We don't even know whether it would have spun. It would have spun, because we didn't see any spin in the whole test match.
Yeah.
So we don't know. But if McGrath was just on a length against our lot blocking it, then we would have been rolled for 80 or something. Mm. The key thing about that 50-run partnership, it was in seven overs.
Yeah.
And if they'd have, you know, duck it, to his credit, he's not scored a run in this series, really, for a guy of his talent. And he obviously got lambasted for getting drunk after second test. There's a lot to unpick in him getting drunk. Why the hell was he on his own would be my point. Like, they pay security people a lot of money. They've got a huge old touring party, England, have done for many tours now. How is a guy wandering around not knowing where he is? Like, that's somebody else's fault.
If you're letting
the young man get pissed, look after him.
Was that one of the findings from the inquiry that Rob Key made into Noosa, pretending you know, there is not a drinking problem? Because the drinking culture and the smoking cigars culture has been a prominent facet or feature of the Baz McCullum, Ben Stokes era, right? Like, they love to have a good time and throw golf into this as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, drinking has had you know, a strong relationship with English cricket for as long as I can remember. It was almost a badge of honour. I mean, they literally had days off in the middle of test matches for Botham to get pissed with people. That's what they did, you know. And it was like, you know, some of Warne's best performances were when he'd been out drinking all night long and turned up to the ground an hour afterwards, famously in the 05 Ashes, where one of his innings he couldn't see because he was still drunk. And then he bowled England out 4 hours later. This lot aren't as good as Shane Warne, and they shouldn't have been doing it. I mean, Duckett's not a kid. Duckett's 31 years old, you know, and he made his test debut, 10 years ago or something. Let's not get bogged down with him going out and getting lashed. He should have been looked after better, so no one should have known that he got pissed if that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, in this day and age, they should have been more careful, and someone should have been with him and made sure he got home. Anyway, he came out and he whacked. He was rubbish all series, Duckett. And so what he did, and I'd imagine quite a lot of pressure. There'd have been a lot of chat sent his way after what he did. It's the fact that him getting pissed isn't a big deal. It's him getting pissed when he hasn't scored any runs and England are 2-0 down is the bad look. If England are winning, do what you want. Anyway, he came out and he smashed 30 off not many. And if he hadn't have smashed the 30 off not many, he looked rubbish in the first innings. He looked quite bad in the 30 off not many. But the pitch preparation from Australia allowed England to roll the dice. And he rolled a 6. Well, he didn't. He rolled a 4.5 or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? But he rolled a positive number by coming out and whacking, and England got 50 up in 7 overs. Crawley didn't quite know what innings to play, but he played a good one. He was sort of half within himself and half not. And I think surviving 50 balls on that pitch, which is something that not many of them did, Head did. Anyone else?
Well,
anyone else faced 50? No, I don't think Khawaja so. Did first innings.
Yeah, he did.
So for Crawley to hang around for 50 balls with his I can't possibly leave it technique, it's a good effort. Duckett did his thing. I just want to talk about the preparation for a bit. And this is something that has been missing in Test cricket for quite a while. So we all know that T20 cricket has taken the draw almost completely away if weather's not around from Test matches.
And I mean, and the World Test Championship also, right? You can't ignore that.
True. I mean, England ignore it. Yeah. They don't know the rules of it, Behram. But a lot of it is down to technique, is that players can't play for the draw anymore. They don't want to. They spend their time range hitting and practicing sweeps, reverse sweeps, scoops, lap scoops, all the rest of it. And so the technique isn't there for teams to block out. But preparation is something that has gone wrong for many teams in the last 3 or 4 years, quite famously, because they miss something fundamental, right? So it's really easy to say, India, for example, when they lost 3-0 to New Zealand at home, which is the single biggest surprise result in my lifetime in Test cricket. 3-0 away in India for New Zealand against the spinners.
Easily.
And statistically, it's the least possible scoreline of any series in the last 30 years. The reason why that happened is because India did what they thought was clever, that was really stupid, is they said, we've got much better spinners than New Zealand, and we are better at playing spin than New Zealand. Undeniable. So all you have to do there is play on pitches that turn a bit and then let the good bowlers show themselves, the good players show themselves, and you'll win. But what they did is created absolutely raging Bunsens.
Yeah.
And therefore, the average spinner becomes amazing, because all he has to do is his margin for error hugely increases, because he doesn't have to land it on a sixpence. He doesn't even have to land it on a dinner plate. He just has to land it somewhere in the right area, and the pitch does the rest. And so fast forward into this test match, Australia 3-0 up, and Australia love beating England 5-0 and do it quite regularly in Australia. And they had a really decent shot. All you got to do, so they identified before this series quite rightly, if the pitch does a bit, England's tactics don't work. So if England have had most of their success chasing on roads, right? Rawalpindi, famously. Most of their success chasing on roads, or chasing these sort of 280 type scores, is they seem to do a lot at the start of this era on quite good pitches, and they come out and they play their shots, and all of a sudden, shit, they're 50 for none off 9 overs. Now what do we do? The panic sets in. So what the curator did here, why he was publicly hung out to dry, none of the players are. None of the players have to come out and answer questions about why they're so shit. But the groundsman creates a pitch where it's over for 2 days for the second time in 4 test matches.
Yeah.
He has to come out and say sorry, and I'm shocked, and I feel really bad and all that. Well, what he was told to do was make the pitch do shitloads, because England can't play on it if we do that. They went way too far.
Yeah.
If the pitch did a bit, Australia are way ahead, and Australia were 64% to win this game, and England were 30% to win this game before a ball was bowled. So all Australia have to do is create a pitch that does a bit, not highway, because they might lose on that, just it does a bit because their bowlers are way better and have been all series, like miles better, and particularly with no Jofra for England. But what they did is they went, we're going all in with the mad pitch, so it's going to do absolutely loads and we'll roll them out. But none of their bats are very good right now. Maybe Travis Head apart, like none of them are having a great series. But they just went, we're going to, that 64% isn't a made up number. Like that's a proper number they were to win this test match. But by creating that pitch, they basically went 50-50. And never mind the percentage, the 6% for the draw. After the first ball, it was 0% for the draw. And the thing is, at least England bowled in the right place, but they didn't have to be highly skilled operators, the England bowlers.
Yeah.
They just had to land it roughly in the right place. At least Carr didn't bomb. At least he didn't go short, which he did in the other test. He just bowled on a length and it's fine. So that's where Australia lost the match more than anything else, more than any other bits of cricket, is they created a pitch that just lotteried it, and England picked the right numbers out the bag.
Yeah, I need to obviously pick your brain a lot more on the lottery pitch. But before that, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Rob Barron and Behram, and go nowhere because we will be back in like half a minute.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Behram and Rob Barron, and we are currently reviewing England's 4-wicket win in the Boxing Day Test at Melbourne. 3-1 is the scoreline, and largely because of the chaotic test match that it was and the lottery pitch that everyone has been talking about. Now, Australia, as we all knew, they lost Pat Cummins and Nathan Lyon before this test match. Lyon is off for surgery, so he won't be featuring in the Ashes. And I'm highly doubtful. Like, I don't think Cummins is either. In fact, we've got confirmation, and he's a big if for the T20 World Cup as well. So now they had that issue of how to fill up that bowling attack. And Todd Murphy was called to the squad, but they did not go for him. And it was quite evident that they'll go for a 4-pronged pace attack. They picked Nisa and Jai Richardson, who was playing his first test in 4 years. And then they opted with Khwaja at 5, got rid of Inglis. That's kind of what they went with. Now, as you were mentioning earlier, all Australia really need to do over here was curate a surface, which did a bit, but they ended up curating one that did a lot. Now, the curator of the MCG, Matt Page, I think that's his name, after the first day's play, when 20 wickets had fallen in the day, he was, you know, questioned, and he said that he was shell-shocked. He left 10 millimeters of grass, and, you know, the question really was that, do you go 12, 10 or 8? Reckon he should have probably gone 8 or 9, and 10 was a bit too much. It was a grassy track. It was a seaming track. The ball was nipping around. Day 1 also had overcast conditions. And then generally, when we see a day's play where 20 wickets fall and, you know, the pitchforks are out, social media goes a bit wild. Oh, if this happened anywhere else, that conversation comes in. And I'm thinking, all right, let's wait for a day. If this flattens out, then it doesn't hurt our game. If it remains one-dimensional, such that even tomorrow it's a bloodbath for batters, then we can call it out. But for now, let's kind of hold our haunches and just see, you know, how this test match progresses. But then, you know, it was proven to be a full-on full lottery pitch, a proper, you know, roll of the dice kind of thing where it's 50-50 between both sides. As you mentioned, you don't need to be a highly skillful bowler to get something out of that track. And it's largely or vastly different from what the MCG used to be, like maybe 5-6 years ago, where it was a batter's paradise, right? Now, we know for a fact that this was a mistake, not just from a you've made the test match one-dimensional and leveled the playing field perspective, but also from a money-making perspective, because there were record crowds at the MCG both days. And a lot more money could have been made had this test match lasted a bit longer. I reckon there's been a loss of 10 million Australian dollars. So Matt Page will be really feeling the heat in that regard as well. I mean, a test match should not just last 142 overs. That is quite you know, unsettling, and no one enjoys that, not even neutrals. And even Crick Viz mentioned that since the start of the ball tracking era in 2006, this has been the toughest pitch to bat on in Australia. And not a single batter scored 50 either. 20 wickets on the first day, 16 on the second. My question to you is, because I know that you agree with all of this stuff, so there's no point talking about that. My question is, do you think that they actually asked for it, or it was a mistake by Matt Page?
I don't think he's the guy that had to come out and be put in the stocks and all the locals throwing their, you know, Christmas Day leftovers at him. I thought that was really harsh. Groundsmen do what they're told generally. And when you're the home team, this is something a lot of people don't agree with. But when you're the home team, create the pitch that you want, right? That's you get an advantage by playing at home.
Yeah.
So play to your strengths and against your opponent's weaknesses. That's part of cricket. It's one of the only sports where the terrain can hugely favour one team.
Yep.
Right. And I know, like, if you play on clay, Nadal's going to be good or whatever, but it's a unique sport, cricket, where there's lots of variables. And if you can tilt them in your favour, you absolutely definitely should do.
Yeah.
Right. I remember Pakistan beating England in the Champions Trophy semi-final. Was it Fakhar Zaman in Cardiff or somewhere?
Yep.
And I was like, why the hell did we create that pitch? Why wasn't that a road where we could just spank you into oblivion?
Hmm.
And they were like, oh, it was the ICC, blah, blah. People have been talking about this stuff for years and years and years. He didn't mess up necessarily. Firstly, it still wasn't a two-day pitch.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't that bad. It wasn't unplayable. It wasn't like, oh my God, that one's grubbing along the floor. That one's hitting him in the throat. Are they going to call it off? It wasn't Antigua, was it?
It wasn't a dangerous pitch. It wasn't New York, for instance, right?
No.
It was just a pitch with a lot of grass, and overcast conditions also helped on day one because the sun was barely out. And I expected, you know, this test match to not go into, let's say, a day four. But I was really hoping that it would go into a day three, especially because it was on the weekend and we all wanted to watch some cricket, right? There was that element of it all in this as well. But, you know, Australia have never lost a test match in their own backyard within. So this was always going to create headlines either way.
Yeah, I don't think it's that guy's fault. I think they probably said, spice the hell out of it. And the players didn't really care. But Australia... Also, England won a really good toss. England won 3 out of 4 of these tosses, despite what Stokes said. This was a good one to win. This was probably the best one to win.
It was a good one to win from the perspective that England would rather chase in these conditions than set a total. Otherwise, I feel like the toss is kind of redundant when it comes to lottery pitches. Yes, you could say that overcast conditions added a bit more juice for the bowlers on day one. So sure, but both teams ultimately batted on day one as well. So I feel like the toss wasn't as important from a conditions perspective, but just from the English psyche perspective, it was a fantastic win for Stokesy. And Smudger wanted to field first as well. So he mentioned that at the toss.
Yeah, I think the overcast conditions is probably, you're right, it's probably tilted it in the favour of whoever won the toss. And you had to bowl. And day one was very typical of England away in Australia. It's like the hope was up, it was down, it was up, it was down, and then it was, oh my God, we've bugged it up again. And we bowled them out for 150. When I started watching, I was like, blimey, this is doing plenty. And then you're 6 overs in and it's 25 for none or whatever. We've missed a real trick here. That was doing lots and it will probably get easier to bat. Australia shot themselves in the head all the way through that innings. You know, they were slightly unlucky with decisions across the test, I thought. You know, the root catch, maybe, maybe not. Half of those go in your favour, half of them don't. I don't want to get into the foreshortening thing. The Cameron Green got run out. It's really stupid. The Khawaja one, did he nick it? Did he not? Snicko doesn't work. So why are we going on that technology? Like all this, like that, slightly against Australia, the universe in this test match. Hmm. But England then got rolled for 110. And you think Australia then, what they had to do is they had very much like England in the first test. We're in a very similar position. Australia were miles ahead of the game and they didn't recalibrate what a good score was on that surface. 250 was a great score on that pitch.
Oh, yeah.
And had Australia scored 250 in the second innings, which they're capable of, they would have won the test easily. Had they scored 200, they probably would have won the test quite easily. But they batted as if they'd already got enough when they had a first innings lead of, what, 40, 42? And then they sat there at... 40 for one and the one is Boland. So they're basically 80 for one on an absolute nightmare lottery pitch. Mm. And they thought they won the game. England did the same thing at lunch on day two in the first test and they lost the test by the end of the day. And Australia, no one took responsibility. And the guy, like, I think Head played quite well, but not a single Sol in the rest of the lineup, and that's 11 bats. So didn't none of them took responsibility. And the biggest culprit of all is Steve Smith. He is most of the reason why Australia lost that test match for me, because he's good enough where that mad movement doesn't affect him too much because he sees it so early. He gets out the way. He looked actually completely fine in that second innings. But what did he do with Nisa, Stark and Richardson, who had absolutely no chance in those conditions of getting runs? He kept taking singles off the first ball of the over bay round over and over again. And we're all going, you can't do that. You know, you cannot expose these guys to have to face all the balls. Nisa, naught, Stark, naught, and Richardson faced 10 balls, I think. So 17 balls those three guys lasted because Smith kept exposing them. Now, if Smith, who never once decided, right, I'm just going to hoof it, he's really good at that, by the way, Steve Smith, when he's in that mood. He's really good at whacking and scoring runs quickly when he wants to. You know, anyone that's watched the Big Bash when he plays, he gets 100 or 50 every time he plays. He can do it. He elected not to. I don't know why, because they didn't have enough. When they're sat there at 120 for seven and, you know, he's lost Cam Green and he knows he's only got people that won't be able to bat on this pitch left, why did he elect for the red inca there? Is that a selfish, I want my average to be north of 50 thing? Because it's around that number, isn't it? And it stayed around that number because he didn't get out. If he's done that, only he will know, it's absolutely criminal. Like, that was a test match. It was so similar to the first one. Australia had that test in the bag. They were way ahead of the game. And then they chucked it away by doing silly things.
I mean, it's a fantastic point, really. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't caught a lot of this test match. So this show is very important for me because I have to talk about this game on Pro Sports tomorrow, and which is why we've got our subject matter expert, Rob, over here. But I watched all the highlights, and that's the stuff you miss in highlights. That Steve Smith has taken singles off the first delivery when he's batting with the tail. And I think that is criminal in a way. I wasn't a big fan of his dismissal versus Josh Tung in the first innings either. I mean, he was going a bit expansive versus that ball. And I mean, you've lost some wickets already, right? I mean, look, Steve Smith is someone who is more skilled than the rest of the batters. Him and Root are probably best equipped to play on hard surfaces, right? Or difficult surfaces. So he's also the captain. I'm not a fan of how he used Scotty Boland, mate. I thought Scotty Boland might have been one of the best bowlers on display in this entire test match. His 3 for 30 in the first bowling innings for Australia. I mean, all those three dismissals are pretty much unplayable. I don't think any batter in the world could fare better. Like, he was nipping it off the deck at good pace, and you don't know which way it's going to deviate. And in the second innings, he takes 2 for 29. He's still terrific. And he introduced him far too late, Smith. I feel maybe that was also a howler. I mean, this is a guy who took a brilliant catch as well and opened the batting. Surely you trust Scotty B at the G.
Yeah, well, he'd shown that he was the right man for the job.
And this is also, by the way, Scotty Boland is a guy who can bowl extremely long spells. You can use him as a workhorse.
On a length.
Yeah.
On a length in the same place over and over again. It was perfect conditions for him. And like you say, you know, they're building at least one statue of him outside the ground. Why the hell didn't he bowl at the start? But the strong captain there sees that Stark might be getting this target. Australia's percentage chance of winning was decreasing very rapidly in that opening stand. Sure, England were lucky, right? England were lucky, but, you know, we've spoken about that pitch allowed them to try and be lucky, and they were lucky, fine. But you don't want Stark bowling one ball and over down the leg side, which he was because maybe he's tired. You know, he's had to do a lot of the work for this bowling attack in this series. He was spraying the odd one down the leg side and they were just flapping at it and getting four, sometimes over the offside, but still, they kept getting four off him. So a strong captain goes, Mitchell is not quite working out. We're going to see what Scott's got because he was bossing it in the first innings. No way Stark says, bugger off. I'm bowling all these balls. He wasn't landing it. And all you had to do on that pitch was land it over and over again. I thought he underbowled Jai as well.
I don't even want to judge Jai too much. He barely gets a ball. And I mean, look, he's returning to the team after 4 years. I'm not going to be overcritical of him. I feel like Jai Richardson is a far better option than Brendan Doggett going into the future, especially when they're, you know, giving long runs or bench runs to some guys. But yeah, I wasn't a fan of the way he used his bowlers. Look, Starkey's been terrific in this entire series and he's taken 55 wickets in 2025 at 17 apiece, right? And his strike rate is like 28 this year in Test cricket. You'd imagine that he'd tire out at some point. He's never taken more wickets in a year at a lesser average as well. So, sure, we can give him a pass as well. Nisa is interesting. Nisa takes 4 for 45 in his first outing, and then England smash him to bits in that, you know, fourth inning. See, he goes for 58 runs in 8 overs, and that's where I feel that Smithy or Smudger could have used Scotty Boland.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he capped him well. I think he had a, I think he had an awful test tactically. I think that's where Australia lost this test. Mm. And, you know, getting out thought by Australia, as I was moaning about on the last one we did, is always frustrating from an English point of view. But this England team are stupid. Mm. And so for Smith to get comprehensively out thought by a bunch of idiots is a bad look for him. Like, he had a real... I think Cummins is a great captain. Like, tactically, he's done some really clever stuff down the years. He's done some timid things. You know, remember when they've got deep point after the first ball of the Ashes away. But England were that dumb that they were throwing test matches at them left, right and centre. Mm. Yeah, Smith had a bad test all the way through. The big booming drive to Tong, you know, I've spoken about Josh Tong yet, who, as we said in the first one, should have been playing anyway.
Yeah, we'll cut him. Don't worry.
It was a pitch where there are some pitches in cricket where there is a natural length. And this, like I said earlier, it wasn't you need to land it on this crack like they were doing in one of the tests where a crack opened up. You didn't have to land it on a crack. You didn't have to land it on a tiny bit of rough. Hmm. You had to land it in a really big area that was like, I don't know, dustbin lid sort of size. If you got it anywhere near there, it was going that way and then it was going that way. You just had to keep doing it. So what you want is accurate bowlers that can just find that natural length and keep hitting it over and over again. Josh Tong was extremely successful because his natural length was landing in that bin lid, right? Mm. It was just going on the spot, and one was going that way, one was going that way, and another one was going that way. And he wasn't unplayable, but he got 7 wickets and he got 5 for 45 in the first innings, and he looked the absolute business. Now, if you've got Nisa and Boland going at it, and one of them's natural length is clearly mega danger and the other one's getting pumped, what do you do as captain? That's not a difficult one. That's not rocket science, is it? It's just, right, go with the good one, the one that's landing it, and tell the other one to have a rest for a bit, because they only need 180. You don't have loads of runs to play with here, and time isn't a thing, so you got to do it now. And sometimes in captaincy, you got to do it now.
How much will you tire Scotty Boland out anyway, because England are going to smash the ball and it's a 180 chase, right? So this is a guy who's known to be someone who can deliver overs or lots of overs, like 10 over spells. And as you said, on a length, he won't miss his spot. He's shown you exactly that throughout this Ashes series. Honestly, this is one of the best series Scotty Boland has had without taking a lot of wickets. That's how I feel about him, because watching him has been like tantalizing. It's all pure magic, right? But we'll come to the English bowlers as well, because I want to talk about them at length, at least the ones who did well. Before that, however, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Rob Barron and Behram. And go nowhere, because we will be back in half a minute.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Behram and Rob Barron. We are reviewing England's 4-wicket win in the Boxing Day Test at Melbourne. And we were talking about England's bowlers, and I want to talk about them in detail as well. But there's this really fun super chat by Abhijit Shivanandan, who says, groundsmen does what, or they do what they're told to, except in Kolkata. Now, it's hilarious that you bring this up, because till this day, I do not know, was it Gautam Gambhir who was protecting the groundsman, or was it, you know, the other guys protecting Gautam Gambhir? Was Sourav Ganguly, you know, right when he said that this is what they asked for? Or was this some weird conspiracy where they pretended that this is what they asked for, whereas they asked for somewhere else? We'll never know. We'll never know. But the one thing I'd like to mention over here, and this is something that really gets on my nerves, right? Anytime we see a test match where 15 to 20 wickets are lost in Senna, there is a hue and cry after day one that, oh, if it was someone else, you'd make a big deal out of it. Ben Stokes mentions this in his post-match presser as well. They have made a big deal out of it. I don't know how else you would like to magnify big deal. This is as big as it gets. We're all talking about Matt Page. How many of you knew that Matt Page is the curator at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, right? Like, look, this was a bad pitch in terms of, you know, the fact that the game got one-dimensional, which is why rank turners are bad, by the way, because the game gets so one-dimensional and it only gets progressively worse. If it's ragging on day one, you know it's not going to get easier for batting. When it comes to pace-friendly demonic tracks, there is always this little hope that, okay, maybe this flattens out, we get a day three. If we got a day three, I don't think there would be much conversation. Now, once that has happened, take this issue to the cleaners. Drag it. Call it out. It's bullshit. We all deserve, you know, a level playing field in the sense that the conditions should be more even for different types of cricketers. It shouldn't be completely skewed in the favor of one type of cricketer. But the whole brouhaha that is kind of, or it erupts right before we know what will happen on day two is something that really annoys me, man. It gets on my nerves. And I know some of you will come and say, oh, Behram's Pakistani. So, of course, he'll say this. No, fuck no. We had Dust Bowls versus West Indies in Multan. I was saying the same goddamn thing. Okay? So,
yep. I mean, baffling. Pakistan played two at the same place. And one of them was like the roadiest road of all time. And then they were getting people to do bloody rain dances on it and setting it on fire and whacking it with sticks and getting people to dig it up with trowels. Nobody knew what was going to go on with that test match. They're like, oh, this one is day seven and it's day one and day one and it should be day seven. Like, the only groundsman anyone knows from Australia is Nathan Lyon. And this poor sod that's done his job, probably done what he was told, is now being strung up by his ankles and pelted at by everybody for probably doing what he was told. As far as Eden Gardens goes, India probably did that thing that I was saying earlier, like they did against New Zealand, and just went, let's have it really spin it. Don't forget, Bumrah got five in the first innings. It wasn't one of those.
Also,
it wasn't one of those where it's just going to rag from ball one and Harmer's going to beat you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really tricky pitch in the sense that there was uneven bounce. Even pace bowling was hard to face. It was like just flat out weird. And my point is that A, that's not the point, but it doesn't help India anymore either. If it did once upon a time, those days are gone, right? And secondly, surely you wait for a day before, you know, creating this ruckus. And where exactly is the hypocrisy? Don't show me BBC headlines. If you guys have been alive for the past 2-3 years, you wouldn't take that shit seriously anyway. Okay? Look at the cricket community. How many people were not talking about the surface? It was obviously the main talking point. So where exactly is the hypocrisy? Why is Boria writing feature pieces on this? Like, it really does baffle my mind because after the 2 days, I agree, it's a talking point. You probably start your shows and your articles with this thing. But really, like, I don't understand where this... I don't want to use the word victimhood because that really would make me look like a dick. But you get what I mean. Like,
yeah,
it's a constant surge and you get it from all corners.
If I'm Matt Page, right, I'm pissed off at the Australian cricketers, the batsmen, for not sticking around for a bit longer. Like, explain to me Steve Smith's shot in the first innings. He's a booming drive. When he's not set, what was he on, 9?
Yeah.
Booming drive. The guy that was really landing it, Josh Tong, probing away on the length. Massive, great big drive from a really, really good player, bold. Marnus isn't that guy anymore. And Khawaja, you know, the Alex Carey dismissal, the leg trap again that he got done with in that test match. And like, Ricky Ponting is a full genius. And you are way better off listening to his commentary than probably anybody else.
How about TNT? You got like speed commentary from the future.
Oh God. Yeah. I made the grave mistake of not coming to my office to watch because it was on Christmas Day in England. And that's a big thing for us. So I watched that at home, the first one. And I had the misfortune of watching it on TNT, which cost bloody 40 quid a month or something. And I am hearing them talking about the cricket from their home on Christmas Day before I'm seeing it with my own eyes that I'm paying money to watch. So he's going bold him for the Steve Smith one, and then you see him get bowled. Like, sod that. Like, give me my money back. Like, that's really shit. So they perform worse than bloody Matt Page or any of the Australians. Yeah. And this is a broadcaster that's worth, I don't know, 500 million to a billion, is in that range somewhere. They're not skint. Send the guys over to watch the cricket and sync up the bloody pictures with the sound. That's not hard. They've been doing it for 50 years, easy. Fix Nico while you're there. Who was it? John Boy, that really funny American guy that does the baseball stuff, who dips into cricket.
Yeah.
He just went, I fixed Nico for you. Just use a better camera. Stop using a shit one that does like one frame every second and do one that does 50 frames every second. Fixed it. Sold. right, don't let me wander down that tunnel because I won't come out of it. Australia played loads of shit shots. And Cameron Green, £2 million Cameron Green is getting for playing in the IPL. Not all that good at cricket, is he? If you watch him in this series, not all that good. He's not used as a bowler because he's not very good at it. He's quite good at fielding in the gully because he's 7 foot tall. He got run out, like really dumb run out in the first innings and looked crap in the second. And he's looked rubbish in the whole series. He's not scored a run. He's not got a wicket. And this is the future. You know, Australia have quite a lot to worry about when the main bats go and the main bowlers go. And we're pretty close. All the main bowlers are getting injured and they're old.
Yeah.
And all the main bats are losing, you know, Steve Smith must be losing his eyesight the way he's playing. It's Khawaja's going. Travis Head will not have the longest career because he's in his 30s already. He plays all formats and he gets drunk between series. So he's not going to be playing when he's 40, is he? I'm losing myself because you've annoyed me with bringing up TNT, Bayram.
Yeah.
But they played bad shots. It's not the groundsman's fault that Cameron Green got run out and Alex Carey got the trap. So the punting point I was trying to make was you could see that dismissal coming. If they put the leg gully there,
it's like
and bowl the ball it's on like the hit, don't hit it to leg gully.
It's like the Sai Sudarshan plan, isn't it? The Alex Carey plan. It's very similar. They're trying to strangle both guys down the leg side. And you're right over there that, you know, some of these dismissals aren't down to the surface. But just to kind of cap this discussion off, because I don't want to revisit it, Sabyasachi Ghosh says, Bayram, the hypocrisy is in the ICC pitch rating and especially the guidelines themselves. If the ICC gives this a satisfactory rating and not poor, then I'm with you. I don't have any issues with that because this is a poor pitch.
Well, how many test matches have there been ever in the last 150 years? It's a lot. It's in the thousands. And the ICC, in their ultimate wisdom, you know, now there's a bunch of idiots, if ever I've seen one, have four categories they can put a pitch in. It's not a scale of 100, which would probably be about right. You could, you know, look at the CricViz guys and some of the guys that we've got here on good areas that can get you some data that blows your head off. They don't say, which one of these four is this pitch? Like no gambler in the world that's making money is putting things into categories of four. It's fine tuning it into the, you know, the third decimal point is how you make your cash. It's not pissing about saying, is it very good, satisfactory, unsatisfactory or unfit? That's all it can be. It's like the Uber driver, isn't it? If you're an Uber driver who's 4.8, you're probably crashing the car once a week. Like it's such a shit scale to only be very good, satisfactory, unsatisfactory, and unfit. It doesn't mean anything. So they come out and they go, "Oh, it's unsatisfactory." Oh, that's terrible. Well, it's like three out of four. Who cares? It doesn't mean anything.
Just to kind of slightly correct you over there. I know that four is a low number, but it's actually six. So we're looking at a very good, satisfactory, unsatisfactory, poor, unfit. If this pitch gets a satisfactory rating, then I 100% agree that is bullshit. Because it can't be in the top three. It's got to be amongst the bottom three for me, right?
Yeah, I thought they changed it to four. And I think it was six, and they thought that was too many for them to cope with. And they moved it. Anyway, it's not many, is it?
Yeah.
But it's not possible to rank things on such a
they
stupidly
small
scale.
They did change it to four, didn't they? I'm just checking right now. Okay, that is stupid. Very good. Satisfactory, unsatisfactory, unfit. Either way, my point remains, if it's amongst the top two and not the bottom two, then that argument is 100% valid.
Yeah, it has to be one of the bottom two. If it's only four, it's four, isn't it? That's a four out of four if there's only four. If it's out of 100, then it's probably, you know, according to the CricViz data that you said, it's the worst pitch in Australia since they've been collecting data.
Yeah.
So it's not going to score very highly if you're scoring properly. But it should have been three. I mean, the fact that we've had two-day test matches out of four is mental. It's absolutely mental. And that is not the groundsman's fault.
Yeah.
It's the application of the modern cricketer is somebody who does not prepare. I mean, Nick Compton wrote a very long and rambling, like one of my soliloquies here. He wrote a very long and rambling piece about how nobody defends anymore, which is absolutely true. They're not practicing the forward defence, are they, when they're sat outside a bar getting leathered in between test matches when they're 2-0 down? The forward defence is pretty much gone. Like, Duckett doesn't play it. He practices it when he's just got out and he's walking off, but Duckett doesn't play it. Crawley doesn't play it. Travis Head doesn't really play it anymore. The Labuschagne tries to play it, but he's gone. You know, he's been performing really badly for quite a long time. Who plays it anymore? And who can elongate test matches when conditions are tough?
Agree with you in theory that modern day batting isn't meant to, you know, kind of go down the grind route and people like to play their shots and like to exert pressure back on the opposition team. But this guy, Arco, regular viewer, says Perth pitch wasn't bad. He's right over here. Those two-day test matches are different. Perth is largely stupid shots and bad decision-making. Whereas I do feel like at the MCG, there's not much you can do, which is why Bazball really works over here. So those are two different kinds of two-day test matches. But let's not forget, Cricket Australia doesn't want this. They want these test matches to go on longer. They got record crowds at the MCG, right? The G was popping. They want more of that. And they want that broadcast money to triple, quadruple as well. None of that happened. So this is something that does hurt the game in many different ways. And just to kind of have this last little monologue on crap pitches, it's not one kind of crap pitch. I don't like surfaces which make the test match one-dimensional. If it's a rank turner from day one and you're struggling to go into day three, I don't like it because it's the spinners are in play from ball one and you barely get to see fast bowlers. Similarly, on this sort of track at the MCG, you get to see seamers dominate for the course of the test match, however long it lasts, and nothing else happens. The bowlers aren't in play, the batters aren't in play at all, and the spinners are defunct. But the worst out of the three is the roads. No one wants to see cricket on roads. I'd take these two conditions over Rawalpindi/Multan of the past, I don't know, before Pakistan turned to spin bowling wickets themselves. So there is nuance to this conversation and not everything is a goddamn attack.
No, it's not. I think people tend, we're in the era of everyone blows everything out of proportion, so they get clicks and likes and whatever else it is. I'm not really in that world of understanding. I don't have an Instagram or anything. I don't need stuff in my face all day, every day of content and people telling me things of hot takes and all the rest of it. I realize I'm being a huge hypocrite by doing what I'm doing right now. But the huge storm of, oh my God, what a terrible pitch. It gives all the cricketers a pass who refuse to knuckle down in a test match. And a test match is a test. It's difficult. It's really hard.
Yeah.
And Australia couldn't be asked with this test match, really. They were like, oh shit, this pitch is really difficult. So we've all got a huge cop-out. We can all say the pitch was really hard. We were going to get out. We got a couple of bad decisions against us. They got lucky, blah, blah, blah. I agree. The Perth pitch wasn't that bad. It wasn't a two-day pitch.
No.
England pissed the test away for being silly when they were in a position of commanding strength. And it wasn't like Australia had 200 to chase in that one, and they chased it two down.
Yep.
Now, England had 180 to chase in this one, and they chased it six down with loads of luck along the way. Yep. They were absolute mega let's swing for the hills and hope for the best. Like, not spoken about Bethel's knock. Like, brilliant tactically, though. England were brilliant tactically. Brydon Carst at number three was absolutely correct. And they would have done Gus as well if he wasn't injured and not allowed. Superb. That's what they should have done. This should happen way more often than it does. The batting order changes based on the conditions. They've got the right openers for the whack anyway. Hmm. And it was so crucial, Bayram, to get that 50. And they got it with some luck. But they got it because they were aggressive and they went after Australia and they smashed the ball slightly into submission.
Yeah.
And when the guys that tried to play properly, Stokes and Root, who are probably the two best of playing properly, they couldn't. They couldn't do it. What did they get between them?
Yeah.
2 off 9 and 15 off 38. They tried to play properly and hold it all together, them two. Not possible on that pitch.
They didn't even score 1/10 of the ultimate score, right? So that tells you something. And that's what Mookie is saying over here, which we've been saying throughout this podcast, is that this is the sort of surface which is tailor-made for baseball, not just from an approach perspective, but from an ethos perspective as well. How these guys function. And England are great at, capitalizing on chaos. It's kind of their thing. And yeah, I feel like had they won the Perth test, this series would have been lit, man. We would have been heading into Sydney, completely locked in. Over here, we're barely watching any cricket anymore. At least I can say that for myself, because it's December in Pakistan, which is wedding season. So I'll probably die if I stay up for these games, right? But yeah, I mean, look, the highlights, the extended ones for both days were less than 40 minutes. So I'm not complaining in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically seeing all of it, aren't you, in 40 minutes. It was nonsense, but the fundamental point that Bazball, or whatever you want to call it, hyper aggression hugely worked on this pitch, tells you that Australia got the pitch wrong.
Yeah.
Don't create the environment in which your opponent thrives, right? Don't give them what they want. Starve them of what they want. Make them work. Mm. England didn't have to work. England had to just up the volatility and go nuts.
Yep.
Gus Atkinson was pretty crucial, even though he was injured. ultimately. He's, what did he get in the first innings? 28 or something.
Yeah, he smashed it.
These are crucial runs. If Steve Smith did what Gus Atkinson did, you know, maybe he'd have scored more than Gus Atkinson did because he's slightly better than Gus Atkinson. Australia could have won that test match. He elected to block and let the tail enders do it for him. I'll keep coming back to that because that is proper criminal. He got a total pass for doing that. No one's dug him out at all.
Also,
that's supposed to be your captain, a most experienced guy.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, after so many catches were dropped by England in the previous two test matches, at least we got a good fielding and catching game. The Stokes catch was brilliant. Bryden Carr's cotton bowled really, really good. Very few drops overall. There was that Bethel drop at fifth slip, the Scotty Boland one, right? Right at the end of day's play. Will Jacks, I think, dropped head at one point, but
Stark, he's got one, yeah. I think that's going to be big.
Stark drops Duckett on eight. That is one catch that could have made a difference, right? Had he latched onto it.
Huge moment. I mean, how often have I said it? It's so unbelievably regular that the team that fields better wins in all formats. You know, I watch a disgraceful amount of cricket, but the T20s that I watch, you line them up and you're like, okay, they're about the same. It's about a 50-50 game. It's always a catch. It's always a catch that settles it, or a stupid drop, or an amazing bit of fielding, or whatever. Yeah. It's something that, you know, England don't have a fielding coach, and they're 3-0 down because they caught much worse than Australia. I mean, as you said, had England won the first test, which they were really short priced to win at lunch on day two, I mean, losing that test on that day is almost impossible. So England should have been 1-0 up with any amount of brains at all. It wasn't skill. It was just zero brains is why they lost that.
Yeah.
Then how well set is this at 2-2?
True.
With one to go, and Australia in trouble with their media for going out and getting pissed, and Australia not really caring and playing stupid shots. It would be a total flip from the points of view where everybody, you know, the hyperbole of everybody is set on fire. Would have resulted in the build-up to this one that nobody massively cares about now, this fifth test. You know, if I, from an England supporter's point of view, 3-2 would be a really shit result, probably the worst possible result for this series for England. 5-0, much better, because they will no longer have five lads that absolutely love golf and beers sitting down, slapping themselves on the back for making the exact same decision every time for everything. They would have had to change something had they got stuffed. If they lose 3-2, they'd be like, well, you know, we should have won at Perth, and then we would have won the Ashes, and we've only won one test there in 15 years, and aren't we great? They will all get a part. The mainstream media, because they're all mates, are hugely giving them a pass. You have Graham Swann standing there on TNT. Again, I had to watch TNT. I'm not making that mistake. Graham Swann standing there and going, Rob Key's a brilliant guy and he's done a great job. Lads. He's his boss, right? He's his boss. He's given him his job. You're not going to stand there on international TV and go, well, my boss is a prick. You can't do his career suicide, isn't it? So he's not going to do that. So stop asking these guys questions. I thought Nasser and Athers did really well when they interviewed Key. They asked him some tough questions. They went, listen, you can't be doing this. You can't be. Why did you do that? Why did you book a holiday a year in advance and you didn't book cricket practice?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do that? They kept asking him questions and he kept saying, don't know, didn't he? He was basically like, well, yeah, we probably should have done, shouldn't I, lads? Yeah.
The most bizarre thing, actually, there were two things that he said which were quite bizarre. One was that, I shouldn't have sent the Ashes boys to New Zealand. Hey, maybe if the Ashes is the only thing that mattered, you'd schedule a couple of test matches in New Zealand outside the FTP, because we know you can, you've done it before. That's one thing you could have done. And secondly, him saying that, if some cricketer is out there having a glass of wine with their dinner, that's fine, but anything else is not. Are you the same Rob Key? Is this the same baseball team? Like, what are we? Have we been smoking something all these years? Like, those things I just cannot, you know, wrap my head around.
Yeah, I think the anger of everyone at nil three was the attempts from the guys in the management to gaslight the fans. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's saying for years that this is the most important thing of our lives, is the direct quote. It's the biggest fish in the sea. It's the biggest show in town. It's massively important. We don't care about anything else. It's all about the Ashes. And they justify losing in 50 over competitions because the Ashes is coming. Oh, we're getting this guy ready. Don't worry. We're getting Jofra and Mark Wood ready. We're plowing so much money from all the best surgeons ever to get these guys who clearly can't play test matches over a long period of time. We're going to bank on them, and we're going to bank on Bashir because we've gone down the pub. It's all silly. And then they come out when they're getting stuffed and say, the Ashes wasn't that big a deal. Mm. You know, we've never said it was. Yes, you did. And like you said it really publicly and really loud. Yeah. And so don't then turn around and do this to the fans.
Yeah.
Word about the fans, right? And it's easy to say, who cares? You know, the fans are going on a lovely holiday to Australia and having a great time. It doesn't matter the result. It does matter. And I've been to 0-5 and I've been to 3-1. It does matter what the results are when you're there. The fans were great, I thought, considering they've been gaslit and mugged off by their own team for not just three test matches, for quite a long period of time, and seen lamentable performances and an attitude that completely stinks on and off the field in all the press conferences. For them to turn up en masse for the record crowd ever, then watch the team get rolled for 110 when they think they're in it, and they then think they're beat when, you know, Boland's the only wicket when they're 80 for 1 or whatever.
Yeah.
To stand there en masse in their thousands and thousands and cheer like mad for that team, who else gets that?
True.
I don't care how pissed. You can't really, like, they all say, oh, they're drunk. You can't get pissed in Australian cricket grounds, Bayram. The beer's like 2%. You're not allowed to. They were standing there supporting their team, going nuts for hours. And I think they hugely contributed to the England victory. Whereas as soon as Australian fans, as fickle as they are, if Australia are not doing so well, they just walk out and they pretend they don't like cricket.
Yeah, well, that's one perspective, definitely. I do feel that, you know, the fans have been kind of, they've been stiffed, right? Like, they deserve better than this. And, okay, shit cricket is one thing, but the messaging that's come out from England's dressing room and the way they've kind of interacted with the media hasn't really done any justice to those fans who really have stuck by them through thick and thin. And they're out there cheering them on, and the Barmy Army needs to be saluted for that. Anyway, we still haven't talked about England's bowlers. I'll come to that after a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Bayram and Rob, and we'll be back in like half a minute, so go nowhere.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Bayram and Rob Barron. We are dissecting England's victory, 4-wicket victory in the Boxing Day Test. And we've got some super chats. We wanted to talk about England's bowlers for quite a while. We've got a super chat on it. Abhijit Shivanandan, second time this show. He asks, what do you think of this England bowling attack with Tung, Cass and Jacks? What satanic ritual does Potts have to do to play a game? I like the way you phrase that. So Josh Tung has been mad accurate. I mean, I found him to be quite erratic in the India series. I haven't watched him in county cricket. I've been told he is, you know, someone who can be accurate over there. But from what I saw of Josh Tung in international cricket, at least in the test arena, his best ball was great, but he would spray it a lot. We saw some brilliant control from him in the previous test match. He took 5 wickets over here. 5 for 45 in the first innings and 2 for 44 in the third. Player of the match, and deservedly so. First England bowler to be awarded player of the match in a test match in Australia since 1998. The guy who got there before him was Dean Headley, grandson of George Headley. That's quite a terrific stat. But look, Tung was the spearhead over here, and they used him to be the tail hoover as well, which they didn't do in the previous game. So they used him well, he performed well. And I mean, Rob Barron over here has been calling for him to play a test match for quite a while now.
Yeah, I thought he looked really good against India when he got his go. What did he get there? He got 8 wickets, didn't he, in the fifth test, which is forgotten about because it's yet another test that England threw in the bin in a really important series, but it didn't matter because the Ashes was coming. But England were 330 for 4 and fell 6 runs short for 367 all out, forgetting that Josh Tung bowled really well in both innings, I thought, against a very good batting lineup. On a pitch that had a bit in it, but he had to work for his wickets, right? He didn't have to work super hard for his wickets on this deck because Australia batted badly and the pitch was conducive. Like when a guy like Tong wins man of the match in Australia, he probably needs a pitch that helps, but his natural length was borderline unplayable. Mm. But to his immense credit, he kept hitting that. he didn't deviate. He didn't go, right, I'm going to bowl short for a bit, and I'm going to, because I haven't got a wicket in 10 minutes, which is what a lot of the others do. Mm. It's what Brydon Carse has done the entire series until this test. It's he just went, well, this thing here is working, so I don't need to overthink. I just need to keep doing this. And he looked really good. To answer the bit about pots, it's very easy to look good when you're not playing and the team's shit. It's you know, your stocks rise a lot. Potts hasn't done quite enough I wasn't calling for Potts to be playing for England. I was like, it's fine if he does. It looked like they, you know, remember they've just banked on Jofra, Mark Wood and Bashir for this series. That's the master plan. Two guys that are always injured and one guy that can't play at this level.
Yeah.
So they've mucked it up. They haven't developed Potts enough. They haven't really developed Tong enough. Mm. You know, they've got Josh Hull waiting in the wings and Sonny Baker, who should be nowhere near Test cricket.
Yeah, you also add Matt Fisher to this list, right? He's part of the squad.
Sure. And who's to say they won't get a go? Now Atkinson's probably injured for the last one. So, we've lost half of the pace bowlers that we took on the tour and the only spinner. So that's a really good effort from the management to have done that level of planning to survive with basically nobody that they wanted. Yeah. So, I don't think Potts was hammering the door down. I think Tong was unlucky not to play earlier, but I get it. Atkinson had an impossibly good start to his Test career that I certainly didn't see coming. And I was saying at the time that I don't see how this continues. And then the next game, he scored 100 with the bat. I'm like, okay, so maybe he's just like the best guy ever at rocking up and being good when it matters. I think he's regressing somewhere near to his mean now, Atkinson. Yeah. His batting's still very useful and his bowling's fine, but he's not a world beater. But you know, when you're up against Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood, Lyon, you're second favourites anyway in home conditions, even if you do get Archer and Wood and everybody else on the park. The fact that Australia have had, you know, most of those guys missing for most of the series should have given England a chance to be more competitive than they were. But
yeah. I mean, look,
is Potts a guy? Don't know.
In hindsight, you could say that Josh Tung could have played earlier. Look, he really troubles Khawaja. I feel like that's been the main theme throughout these two test matches, and he finally gets his wicket over here as well. But you give him his flowers, and I mean, it's too soon to say what he'll end up being, but at least he's come up and kind of raised his hand, and he's become the first guy since Dean Headley to win a Player of the Match award in Australia. In this Super Chat, Abhijit, you're missing one big name, by the way. And I feel like after Josh Tung, you're kind of looking at Ben Stokes, aren't you? When you look at, you know, the bowling attack, he was England's best bowler versus India. Even in this test match, he takes 4 wickets, I think, 1 for 25 and 3 for 24. But you can credit his contributions to this English test side when it comes to his bowling. He's basically been a bowling all-rounder for a bit, right? I feel like he is the most key now. We've lost Jofra and Atkinson. You're looking at Tung, Stokes, Brydon Carse is going to be there inevitably. He's going to end up playing all 5 test matches. And he picks up 5 wickets over here, right? 1 for 42 and 4 for 34. But to your point, I don't know what to make of that. Because finally, he stops bowling short and wide, but the surface assists him a lot. So how much of this was the surface and how much of this was Carse? I don't know. The thing I'm fascinated with is he's the first Dayhawk. Bye-bye, Nighthawk. You've got Dayhawk, Brydon Carse. Love it.
Correct. Absolutely correct. England tactically were very good because it was the you know, as we said before, the carnage mode needed to be activated.
Yeah.
And playing Carse at 3 was excellent because just after the wicket, which to be fair, they got 50 on the ball before the wicket happened. Putting Bethel in there if he's poking about and in tough conditions, if he nicked off early, which he absolutely could have done, then the panic can set in and you're like, oh, well, Gus can't bat yet because of this. And you can get a bit messed up. The clarity, right? And that's something that England have hugely missed despite preaching it. And I'm with it as well. Like, it's so important. Clarity of role and clarity of what your job is. Go out and do it and be back to the hilt to do that job, right? That's the bit I totally agree with this regime. And they discombobulated themselves in Test 2 and 3 because they were worried about the backlash of the media that they say they ignore but clearly don't. They were worried about the backlash for playing in the mad way. So when they did get the conditions, they blocked and they wussed it. Right. And Stokes, as you rightly say, was our best bowler by miles against India. But this is an old man with a dodgy knee who we're banking on to be a good bowler now.
Yeah.
And he couldn't bowl on one of the pivotal days of the series because he was too tired because he'd been blocking all day the day before with the bat. It's asking a lot for Stokes to be good. It's the fact that this current setup seemed to want to pick guys that are big, tall, strong and whack it. That is above all bowl fast. That is above anything else. It's above the amount of wickets taken or runs scored or temperament to play the game properly, any of these. And the fact that they're awarding central contracts to Sonny Baker, Bayram, let's not forget, we keep saying it, but let's not forget that 700 wickets man wasn't allowed to play in this series because they said he was going to be shit by now. No evidence to support that, right? He was still bowling really well. And Stuart Broad, a good management team would have had Stuart Broad still playing now, right? Yep. Because he wouldn't have wanted to retire after his best mate was just booted into touch, right? He wouldn't have wanted to. He was still bowling really, really well, Stuart Broad, when he quit. So they could have had Broad and Anderson. Sonny Baker gets a central contract, right? Now, again, I watch a lot of cricket and I've seen a lot of Sonny Baker, and I must admit, he can bowl quite fast.
But can he, so this is very interesting. I'm sorry I'm interjecting over here, but serious soccer fan bot says that Stokes should have taken the new ball from the off as he has the ball on a string. He was their best bowler this summer. Also, Stokes should have come in at number three. So barring Josh Tung, in the last three innings that we've seen from England, bowling innings, Stokes has landed in the same goddamn area over and over and over again, right? But I still feel it might be a bit too radical for him to take the new ball, although I do see reason over there when you've got Cass as a new ball bowling option, right? So it's an interesting one that serious soccer fan Bart has brought up over here.
Okay. All right. To pivot to that, I think in certain conditions, Stokes opening the bowling is the right answer. And I think Cass not doing it is also the right answer in quite a lot. The bit that really annoyed me about Cass earlier in the series was when he took the first over, I think it was against Weatherald, and he beat the bat four times in a row and nearly got a wicket by bowling full and it was swinging away. And you're like, this is what you want. This is well done, Bryden. This is it. Just keep it there. And he dropped his length back 4 feet and got smacked like Weatherald, you know, who's absolutely not up to it at this level by the looks of him, got 70 odd because they just fed the cut for it. Yep. We spoke about it at the time over and over again because we were stupid, right? England was stupid. And so there are times like that, rather than just persevering, goes back to the Sonny Baker thing. You know, Sonny Baker's numbers, go and look at them. He's like 12 and over or something in his England career so far. And he's 32nd best figures in the county championship. He's the 85th best figures in the blast.
Arco says that he averages 34 over here. So I reckon he's probably looking at his first class average because that's the one that matters for the test team. Not quite sure.
Sure. But he got picked. He got picked for the ODI team, Bayram, when he hadn't played a 50 over game for 3 years. And they're like, well, what am I watching here? What's he doing for England? He's going at 10.85 and over in ODIs. He's played once. And in T20Is, he's going at 13 and over and he hasn't taken a wicket. Why does that guy get a central contract? It doesn't answer the guy's question about Stokes, but I think certain times Stokes should open the bowling. Stokes shouldn't have batted three in this. I totally disagree with that because we saw that the two guys who are our best two players at playing test match style batting and soaking up pressure and all that, they tried to do it in that innings and they both failed pretty miserably. Mm-hmm. Like if everyone batted like Stokes and Root did, which they absolutely should have done when they were 80 for one in a one innings game in a really important first test, that's how they should have batted then, rather than all in Brisbane when they were all driving Mitchell Starc on the up. That's how Stokes and Root should have batted then. Instead, Stokes chose to bat. Actually, even though Stokes has had all the praise this series, and I know I get criticised for always murdering Stokes, he picked the wrong choice again. He went for block when it should have been whack. And he's done the wrong thing, like four in a row for me. Huge praise for blocking out when the conditions were really good at Adelaide. Huge praise he got from everybody. Couldn't bowl because he blocked for ages. And England got stuffed in the test, but that didn't matter because Stokes batted for a while. He just tried to hold an end up. Sure, he did try and play a shot and got out, so fair enough. But no, if Stokes would have been three and batted like that, and then Bethel comes in and the panic could have set in, England won reasonably narrowly. And like they're only a catch or two away from not chasing those. They upped the volatility and they won. And fair play that they did it in the right way. They went for it and they got it.
Some really interesting comments over here by Arco, who says, hear me out, what about Sam Cook? And then he says, and why was Ollie Robinson booted? Ollie Robinson bagged a gig with Wisden last I checked. I haven't really heard from him since then. But Sam Cook is an interesting one because he doesn't fit the bill when it comes to baseball style cricket. Like, there is a video of Rob Key saying somewhere that if you're nipping the ball around at 75 to 80 miles per hour, you're no good. And enter Michael Neeser. I know that he got whacked in the fourth innings, but he's taken wickets in this series, and they got rid of Jimmy for this series. They clearly misunderstood what the surfaces are going to be like in Australia. That's one part of it. But the bigger question now, I know it's a dead series, no one cares, but I mean, Zach Raleigh cares. He thinks 3-2 would be a great result. So England have lost Atkinson. They've lost Jofra. Cass, we all acknowledge, is not a new ball bowler. Even on the days he does well, an anomaly, but usually he's just kind of, you know, feeding the openers width to cut, right? That's basically been him. Short and wide or full or wide or drifting down the pads. It's always erratic, or mostly it's erratic. Let's assume they've got pots in, all right? Because they need a new ball bowler. Someone's got to take the new ball. Do they need a second new ball bowler over here? I think they do.
So I don't think Sam Cook's the answer, given his overall numbers and the fact that he had a go, and he had a go recently against Zimbabwe, and he, bear in mind, that's against Zimbabwe, and sure, it wasn't bowling conditions. You know, England got 560 declared. Bennett got 100, though, and Bennett got 100 against Sam Cook, and Sam Cook bowled, I'm cheating here because I'm looking now, Sam Cook, 17 overs, 1 for 72 at 4.23 and over against Zimbabwe. That's not putting your name in the hat for the Ashes. Second innings, 14 overs, 3 maidens, none for 47. Second innings, Zimbabwe following on here. And Sikandar Raza and Sean Williams were smacking it everywhere, weren't they? Like they played really well. What was their partnership? 120 or something. He had a chance, albeit against Zimbabwe. But if you're playing Zimbabwe, you know, Ollie Pope will tell you, you've got to take your chance. And he got himself in the Ashes from scoring runs against inferior, let's be honest, slightly inferior opposition. And Sam Cook didn't take his. It's a sample size of one, so it's a bit rough. But his numbers, when you look at Sam Cook's numbers, which I'm looking at now, they don't hugely jump out as we need this guy. Yet, you can say we need new ball bowlers. What they really needed was Fitch Offer a fit. Mark Wood, but it was extremely unlikely, based on a huge sample size of masses of evidence, that Wood and Archer wouldn't get through the series. We said it before the series, we said it during the series. There's no way they play all 10 between them, and I'd be very surprised if they play 5. And that's not me being a doctor or having any surgical skills. That's by watching loads of cricket and watching these guys be made to bowl time and time again when they're carrying injuries. It's so difficult, the rigors of Test cricket. If you're a fast bowler, and England have time and again got it wrong. And I think the total lack of care or planning or any sort of nous around the bowling thing is a really big issue for England. And not having a bowling coach, a settled one, and allowing bowling coaches to play in golf tournaments instead of be with the team, allowing them to play in the IL20 and bowl like an absolute drain, which is what Tim Southey's doing at the moment, instead of being with the team. And then getting the coach from 15 years ago to come back and go, well, can you work with these guys? We're playing the Ashes in a couple of weeks. Yeah, fine. How much are you paying me? Like, no planning going on here. And McCullum, Key, Luke Wright, not the guys to be telling you what to do as bowlers, really. You know, Luke Wright bowled a bit. He bowled quite fast at one point in his career. But he's not the guy, is he? You're not like, oh, I really want to hear what Luke Wright's got to say. And I definitely don't want to hear what Brendan McCullum and Rob Key have got to say about what we desperately need in a bowler. Why isn't Jimmy Anderson with them all the time?
Yep.
Or why isn't a proper bowling coach sat next to a proper fielding coach and coming up with plans and you know, this is what we need in Australia? None of that shit's happened, Bayram, has it? And England, grossly underprepared, let's not forget, for this series. Australia handed them a test match, or a good chance, they won it. Happy days.
I'll tell you what they did do. They thought of Will Jacks as their frontline spinner. That's what they did, not give Shoaib Bashir a game. And look, he was the frontline spinner once again over here, but it didn't matter because it wasn't that surface. Although, finally, Ollie Pope lost his place in the starting 11. Jofra was replaced by Atkinson, so that's a big question mark now moving forward. They'll probably bring in Potts, or if not, then Matt Fisher, I suppose. But the Bethel experiment is interesting. The guy doesn't have a first-class 100. He chances his arm, scores a crucial 40, which is a very, very, handsome, I suppose, on this track. How do you kind of view the whole Bethel experiment? Because I feel like even if it works in the short term, you're kind of both screwing over yourself and Bethel in the long run.
Yeah, so the Bethel one's interesting because they've fully backed Ollie Pope for a long time, and it feels a bit like they haven't backed him because of what's happened in this series, but they fully backed Ollie Pope, where a lot of England setups in the past would have binned him off a long time ago. I said this before this test match. Him and Crawley, they've played 125 test matches between them, and when you watch them playing in Australia sometimes, particularly Pope, he looks like a guy who's on his first tour that doesn't know what he's doing. Now, Bethel didn't look like that, and he was a young guy on his first tour. And he's also had his progress as a cricketer stymied by this setup because he's been carrying drinks for ages. No surprise that he was, you know, chatting up birds in nightclubs after the second test, right? That he's a 21, 22-year-old kid. He's allowed out with the older guys. That is going to happen, right? We can't call the guy out too much for that. You know, what 22-year-old going on his first tour isn't going to be in the pub if all the other guys are, right? Mm. All good. What is absolutely made for Jacob Bethel in his first test match is England are 3-0 down. You're playing on a lottery pitch. Go out there and smack it and see what you got. And it was perfect situation for him. He could have got out mega early, but he didn't. You know, Harry Brook could have got out first ball doing what he did. He could have got out first ball, but he didn't. And when you're playing lottery cricket, you do need the right numbers to come up to some extent. You know, there are people who are lucky in life, and there are people who aren't. And most of life, sorry to burst bubbles out there, is just pure luck. Who you know, where you are, all that sort of shit, right? Everything's luck. Bethel was lucky that he came off for his 40. He didn't score a blazing 100, but he scored 40 or 46, which probably made the difference. It probably won him in that test match, his knock. And he played some lovely shots. The reason why they've banked on him is because he looks amazing.
Yeah.
When it's, I said this before, when it comes off the bat for Bethel, the blade is so, it looks so good when he bats, and it sounds good aesthetically. He is a joy to watch, but Bethel, when it's coming good. Absolutely. The trouble with this setup is they don't reward consistent performances. They seem to reward nonsense performances. So I can't quite remember the numbers, but Bethel's knock against India, when Bumrah cleaned him up, he was like, I can't remember what it was, 5 off 30 or something. And then Bethel ran down the pitch at Bumrah and tried to smack it. So here's his run, right? I wrote it down at the time. In the 100, which is when they were electing they were picking the squad. In the 100, he'd got 8 off 8, no wickets, 1 off 2, no wickets, and 5 off 7. That was his contribution. In the test match that he played, he got 11 runs, no wickets, and the worst innings of here it is, 5 off 31, bold slogging against Bumrah. In the T20s, he got 7 off 4, 13 off 10, and 6 off 4. What did the England setup do then with Jacob Bethel? They made him captain of the limited overs team after that run of form, right? So that's the punchline to that, is they made him captain. So what chance has the guy got? It should be arm round him, get him playing cricket as much as possible. That's what you need precocious talents to be doing with their time, is playing cricket. You know, chatting up birds in bars, great. But during the day, make the guy play cricket, not carry drinks for guys that are probably worse at cricket than him. I don't know how good he's going to be. They need to do a better job of looking after him and improving his cricket. And I can't let a podcast go by without mentioning Tribe. Yeah. He was playing in the, like, he's absolutely bossed it on the Lions tour. The only one that did, the only one that got runs and got ton and a 50 not out. He was playing in the SA20 yesterday because he looks good. Is that the right answer? Should he be doing that right now? If they're trying to turn him into the next England number three, number four. And another thing, right? Like, I think Vaughan said this. How is he number three, Bethel, coming into the series at 0-3? How is he the number three? Whereas, you know, back in the day, you were the number seven and then everyone else just moved up one and accommodated you that way. Such a difficult thing to... So let's say he got naught or naught in this test. What do they do then? They drop him? Is it another year and a half of carrying drinks for other people until he gets to play again? The problem I've got with all that is I don't really know. That's not the problem I've got. That's fine. But the setup don't really know, do they? That seems to be quite clear that they're not quite sure what to do with these guys, because Bethel would have been the guy for this series. They desperately wanted him to be, but he didn't score any runs. And Pope did score loads of runs against a team that weren't particularly good. And they're like, well, we kind of got to go for Pope then. And they don't seem to have any coherent decision-making skills, which is costing England multiple matches in different formats. Don't know.
Well, we'll see as time unfolds itself. We'll know what the future holds for Jacob Bethel. Anyway, we've harped on about this game for a long time. We've got a couple of super chats, and let's take those and kind of call it a day. We've got Blue Eagles 2021 asking, last four IPLs had different champs and permutations of qualifiers. Is there more parity due to teams getting smarter, or just the ubiquity of Indian talent? I actually feel it's the franchise model. You've got these mega auctions and your team gets completely, you know, dismantled after a couple of seasons. If you are a franchise team owner in the T20 circuit, you are not building a core for the future. You are not even thinking long term. You're thinking short term, how to win the next one. And that's why you see so much volatility now. At least that's my take on it. The lack of enough retentions, if you will.
I would have given the same answer as you did, Bayram. So, yeah, I'm not going to repeat what you just said. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. And it sucks. Like, it's vastly different from the football model that way. And why would you even want to invest in youth when you can just go for the guy who's in form? And that's where the franchise T20 model is really, really flawed in my eyes. All right. Now we've got the final super chat of the day. Andy1999 asks Pakistan, or he has a statement over here. Pakistan are T20 World Cup contenders. They're well suited for Colombo. Hitting skill gap won't matter as much on slower pitches. Shadab's form a game changer. So, look. Shadab Khan, as far as his profile is concerned, makes sense. Someone who can bat in the middle overs, whack spin. He's been in somewhat form at the Big Bash. He's another one of those multifaceted cricketers that Hessen loves to have. This is the same guy, Mike Hessen, who, by the way, had what? Nathan McCullum, Corey Anderson, Colin DeGrand, home. Give me another name, man. Corey Anderson. Jimmy Neesham. Jimmy Neesham's another name. He works with these sort of players. They kind of help him bat till 8, and then he has 3 frontline seamers. So Shadab fits the bill, and he's Hessen's guy from Islamabad United as well. He would have told Shadab that you can go and get your surgery done, complete your rehab, and I'll give you a way back into the team. So I'm not surprised that he's back in Pakistan, probably need him. What I'm not too sure about is that, will the pitches be slow if they're evening games? Will dew play a factor? We don't know those things yet. It's still too early in February. It's a cold month, generally. I don't know what the weather is like in Sri Lanka, but I would assume it's not terribly hot at that time in Colombo. I have no idea. I've never been. But Pakistan would have been World Cup T20 contenders, or T20 World Cup contenders, sorry, if they knew how to bat. This is a team that has 5 openers in the starting 11. They've bowled exceptionally well in the Hessen era and fielded exceptionally well. And they've upskilled as a team in those two facets. But the batting is so shoddy that even if they have a good run, maybe semi-finals, right? Like, they've got a favorable draw, both through the group stage and the Super 8 stage. But I think they'll learn, or need to learn, how to bat if they want to lift that trophy.
So when I do my ratings for teams and players and everything else, I come up with my numbers for how likely a team is to win each competition. I haven't done the World Cup ones yet because I don't know who's fit. I don't know who's in the squad. But when I was doing it for Big Bash, for example, you're like, which ones are available? How do they set up? Have they got a finisher? Have they got power play hitters? Have they got the guy that's going to do the power surge? Have they got someone that can bowl at the start? Death? Containing the middle, whatever, right? And whenever I've done this for World Cups and international events, I can do it for every team apart from Pakistan, because there are so many huge question marks next to Pakistan. Which Pakistan turns up, they've done stuff that is mathematically impossible in tournaments before, where it's like they need 4 other teams to lose by exactly the right margin and it to rain over there.
Yep.
At the same time, by winning by 80 runs, and then all that happens and they qualify. Like, Pakistan are a total mystery and have been for my cricketing life, as far as watching it and betting on it and talking about it goes. Sure, they're contenders because you never know what's going to happen. I would say it looks currently, as it often does, like it's a bit of a shambles, because I'm doing the Big Bash at the moment. It's part of the reason why I'm quite tired is the Bloody Ashes is on. I'm doing the Big Bash. So that's every morning for me is another 4 hours of T20s. And the Big Bash betting is all about, do you know which ones are available and which ones are going to clear off? And they've got a series against New Zealand coming up to tune for, is it against New Zealand? Which is the series they've got?
Pakistan have got Sri Lanka coming up, and then they've got Australia before the T20 World Cup.
So they just named the Sri Lanka squad, didn't they?
Yes.
New Zealand have got a different one in the Big Bash, sorry. So you go through which Pakistan players might be available, and you just assumed that at least two out of Shaheen, Rizwan and Babar would be in that squad for the tune-up for the World Cup. And then they came out and said, Cricket Australia said, all of the Big Bash guys are going to stay.
Yeah.
The Pakistan one. They're not going to go. So is don't worry about it, lads. So I'm thinking, well, I don't know. As ever with Pakistan cricket, I don't know. And for it to, so they have Shaheen, who's now injured, who bowled pretty crap in the Big Bash. He wasn't landing it. I mean, one of his spells, his first game, he had to come off. He was going at 16 and over and he got no ball out of the game. He was awful.
Yep.
Slightly better signs the next game, but he still couldn't land it on the stumps. He was swinging it past the stumps, which the old Shaheen, the good Shaheen, would have cashed in those conditions. So he's hobbled out. So maybe they're not picking him because he's injured. They've got Ralph as well, who bowled very well today, for example. Why isn't he in the Pakistan squad? And then Rizwan and Babar, I don't want to start you off because that's a long conversation. But Rizwan,
I don't think it is.
Ralph Afridi, if you had those four guys at the peak of their powers, they are World Cup contenders, but they've elected to not put them in the squad for their pre-World Cup series. So, don't know.
I mean, I think there's been some sort of deal between Cricket Australia and the PCB, which happened prior to the point where they scheduled the series versus Sri Lanka in Sri Lanka, because they thought this is a good chance to acclimatize. And some of those guys will. But if Babar is going to be selected for the T20 World Cup, then he should be playing that series, because he's the sort of guy you want to have, you know, a good amount of games in certain conditions. But I don't think he's a lock either. Like, you look at Farhan, Fakhar, Saim, Babar, you're not picking all of them. You're picking three of them at best. They've got a wicketkeeper.
You're not picking Babar in his current form, are you?
Yeah, you're not. I don't think you are. And Rizwan is, I think that's a lost cause. Those days are far gone where you could have an accumulator up top. You need someone who can at least smash it a bit. Or, you know, the catch-up knock thing doesn't work anymore. It used to for a bit when Pakistan had a splendid attack. Ralph might still make the squad, I feel, because they like him and he's been doing well. It's just that he's a different beast altogether, a different animal in Australia. And he's probably born in the wrong country anyway, because his bowling suits those tracks a lot better. And I mean, it's ultimately between him and Wasim Jr. I think they might opt for him. Shadab has returned with the team. He's a part of that series because they want him to get some game time in a Pakistan jersey. But yeah, it's interesting what sort of decision Hessen ultimately makes, because it's going to be his team. Maaz Sadakat is a kid who they could have taken a punt on, but they're not like kind of going with him for now. And I'm happy in a sense that if you want to induct him, you give him a long run. Don't just try and, you know, experiment with him in the World Cup, and if it fails, we never see him again for 3 years. Don't do that, right? That's what not what good teams do. So it's always going to be a question mark, but until and unless they can figure out their batting, I'm just not entirely sold. Although, if the wickets get tired, come Super 8 stage, if Pakistan have New Zealand, England and Sri Lanka in their Super 8 group, I see a semi-final spot potentially for them. It's just winning the goddamn thing is a bit of a stretch for me. So I would say dark horses at best, not quite contenders. And it's Pakistan. Even from winning positions, they'll manage to screw it up, right? And they've only ever won trophies when they've got their backs against the wall. So how can we even say anything? Anyway.
Yeah, they're certainly not going to be favourites. I'm surprised that Shadab is the one out of all those that we've mentioned that is the only one that's in the squad. However, he's got his bowling back. And he took a three for the other day in the Big Bash, where one of them was a stumping, really, really good bit of bowling. Mm. His old tricks have come back. I think he lost it with action change and all that, but that's come back now. So he is turning the ball a fair bit. His batting, he got 25 today, I think. His batting is absolutely fine. And he's that guy, isn't he? If you're Hessen, you've got a proper batting all-rounder. I mean, you've got a proper bowling all-rounder who can smack it.
I actually think you now look at him as a batting all-rounder, because we're not entirely sold on the bowling. I know what you're saying. We all saw the butt cheek video of Jared's, right? Like, he's got 1.5 butt cheek in now, not two yet, but first it was one prior to the surgery and rehab. So I feel like, yes, he could be a potential bowling option, but I'm really looking at Shadab to provide some impetus in the middle overs if he's playing. I feel like his primary role in that Pakistan team would be as a batter, and he would have to share, you know, 8 overs amongst himself, Saim, Fahim, Nawaz, those guys. And then they'll go for 12 overs of frontline bowling. It's an interesting one. I feel like Hessen is still an intelligent man. If someone can, he can. But winning the trophy is a bit of a stretch. I feel like contenders is too big a tag for Pakistan. It always is. In fact, when they go into tournaments as contenders, they flop. They'd rather be underdogs. Let them be underdogs. Anyway.
I agree.
Yeah. All right. I suppose that's a wrap. Thank you for sticking with us for over 90 minutes now, guys. We appreciate all the interactions and these super chats. Just to tell you that, you know, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the fun work that we do as part of our team, whether it be written content, videos, or podcasts. And all of our shows on the Good Areas Network are powered by our supporters on Patreon. And you can become one of them as well by going to patreon.com/Good Areas Podcast. That way you can enjoy ad-free content, you can talk to us exclusively, and you can give us podcast recommendations. All right, then. That's it for today. We'll be back for one last time, me and Rob, when the Sydney test ends. It's been good fun. Finally, we've got an English win. And I just hope the last test is also weirdly chaotic and stupid, because that's what this Ashes series has been all about. And it shouldn't change now. Anyway, have a good one, folks. And goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baron Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.